Oh my God, it feels good to be back. Oh, I've missed this room. So ready.
The CMU podcast in association with Seven Digital.
This week, RIAA, Songkick, Spotify, and Justin Bieber. I'm Andy Malt, editor of CMU. My guest this week is Chris Cook, the business editor of CMU. And having not been here for 2 or 3 weeks, and having had a guest in that time, or several guests if you count last week, sort of feels a bit weird calling you my guest. I'm going to persevere with that joke forever.
Never let it be said that CMU doesn't take its weak gags. And then just keep going.
just
if it works,
to the floor.
It works for Stuart Lee and Mark and Lard and Harry Hill. So some of the greats,
yeah, look at them.
Some of the greats have cracked the taking the weak gag
some
and just
people,
running with it forever.
Some people
one
have
day,
made money from endless repetition, and we're hoping one day that will work
one
for
day
us.
It'll work for us. I'm just not sure that is what it's going to
anyway,
be.
Anyway, the big news is I'm back.
So 2 editions, 3 weeks that you've been missing.
Yeah.
So you weren't here last week. You weren't meant to be here last week, because last week we were at the Convergence Festival in Shoreditch.
I don't go to festivals.
And we had our CMU Insight session, which we obviously had the highlights from. There is actually more of that session, because it was a 2-hour session and we only had about 45 minutes of it. So at some point, I think I did say on the post later this month, there's not much of this month left, isn't there?
No, you have to hurry.
That was a bit ambitious. At some point...
That's another one of CMU's long-running gags, is saying, oh, we're going to do this later this month.
At some point before the end of time... I'm committing to that.
I think you're over-committing.
That's a commitment. You can have that. It's on record.
I don't think you should be that. I think you should, you know, put some grey areas in there.
At some point before the end of time itself, I will post the extended highlights of CMU Insights at Convergence. It will go on our Mixcloud profile, because Mixcloud organised a recording for us.
So they get the exclusive.
The prize. What a prize. The prize is the Mixcloud profile, but only the Mixcloud profile will get the extended highlights, CMU Insights at Convergence at some point in the distant future, maybe before the next Convergence Festival.
Maybe we'll
do that thing where we'll run it in the week before the next Convergence Festival, and we'll say, oh, it was always our plan. Let's preempt the next edition. It was always our plan to leave it a year.
Yeah. So everyone listening now, forget you first this bit of the conversation. It's, just wait and see what happens, why don't you? Have a bit of mystery in your life.
So that was last week. But then the week before that, that was the week that you were claiming to be ill.
I was very ill.
So that was what happened that week. And Brittany Bean stood in at the last minute because you were claiming to be ill. And and that was the fourth day you claimed, because you started claiming you were being ill on Monday.
Well, no, I started claiming to you. I told you on Saturday I was ill. I got ill. I started getting ill on Friday afternoon. It was like a countdown. I thought, well, I'm not feeling very good. I better finish writing everything I need to write. And it was just like a race against the clock before I couldn't work anymore. And it just got to a point where I went, I'm going to go and lie on the sofa and shiver now.
So by the Thursday, you had been basically dead for 6 days, completely. So even if you'd been...
It's like the story of Easter.
And then you rose again. It's all very relevant.
On the Saturday.
On the Saturday, 7 days. Yeah, that's nothing like Easter. What are you talking about?
It's a bit like
Easter. And there were no bunnies involved at all. There is nothing to do with that and Easter. But even if you had been better on the Thursday, because you kept doing that thing every day where it's like, tomorrow I'm going to be better. And then you weren't. But because you've been dead for 7 days, you would have nothing to say anyway.
It's true.
So whereas...
I didn't actually know what had been happening in the music industry. I would have been absolutely useless.
Or the world.
Or the world.
Whereas the last 7 days, you've been so on top of the music industry.
Oh, yeah.
Completely in tune with all of the big key developments. And I look forward to learning what has happened in music in the last 7 days from what is still to come on this edition of the CMU podcast.
Yeah, but first things first, everyone go and get flu jabs. That is the big takeaway, I think.
Is everyone allowed them?
Everyone's allowed them, yeah.
Do you have to pay for them, or are they free on the old
NHS?
You
have to pay for them unless you are old or have asthma and I think some other stuff.
And some other stuff. Probably free in Scotland. These things are usually free in Scotland.
Well, they have a better system in Scotland.
So go and have a flu jab. But not now, surely. You want me to do that in like October?
It's like October, November time. I'm just saying now.
I'm pretty sure. Isn't there not most years, like there's a tabloid story, we're short of flu jabs. And so there's an element of, well, if you're a healthy, how old are you these days? 48?
These days. It depends on my mood.
So if you're in your very late 30s.
I'm not in my very late 30s.
Mid to late?
Mid.
Late mid?
Mid mid.
If you're somewhere, you know, close to your 40s, then they say, if you go and have a flu jab, that's some old person not able to have a flu jab, probably dead. So that doesn't that story go around most autumns, that there's a shortage of whatever
maybe,
it is?
Maybe, but I was taken out of the workforce for a week, and that can't be a good thing.
Well, I don't know. We got to have Brittany Bean on the podcast. That's possibly a good thing.
It was quite a good thing.
More flu. That's what I say.
Well, you can have flu next year.
I'm too busy. Too busy to have flu. Anyway, that's not what we're here to talk about today.
Should we talk about the RIAA, still the most stupid acronym in
music? Have we talked about that on the...
Well, we have to, because it's so hard to say.
The Recording Industry Association of America. At least they do have what they do in their name, as in to say they've gone with recording rather than phonograph, which we were actually talking about before the podcast today, that the UK...
Phonographic.
The equivalent of the RIAA in the UK is the BPI, which is a lot easier to say.
BPI, 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 see?
And then you've got the Global Trade Body, which is the IFPI, not quite as easy to say as BPI, but it's still...
Still easier than... RIAA.
But both of those are not going with the word recording. They're going with the word phonographic, which is one of two things. When you say phonographic to people, they either have no idea what that means, or they think you've just said pornographic.
Yeah.
And they then think you're talking about some global trade body for the porn industry. But the thing we were talking about earlier today before the podcast is how the BPI, so it's the British Phonographic Industry, is what it stands for, UK trade body. But for a time, their actual name was the British Recorded Music Industry, recognising the problem that we've discussed, that no one knows what phonographic means.
Yes.
But they didn't change their initials. So they were still the BPI, but that stood for the British Recorded Music Industry.
And then they eventually stopped doing that because it was stupid.
So anyway, we're not here to talk about the IFPI or the BPI. No. What have the RIAA, the Recording Industry Association of America, what have they done that's of note this week?
This week they have announced the US record industry's revenues for the last year.
So all the trade bodies put out their figures and they sort of drip feed them. The BPI normally put out their figures quite early in January, and then the French industry, and then the Nordics, and then the Germans, and it gets really tedious. And particularly as the aforementioned IFPI, next month, I think around the 12th of April, I think it's set to happen, put out one book that gathers it all together. So all the trade bodies drip feed their individual
figures.
So
you might as well just wait for that.
Exactly. We have to all go and scrutinise those figures. And then basically every country pretty much, I mean, Japan is always interesting.
Yes.
But most countries, it's basically the same trends with some slightly different figures. So we might as well just all wait until the RIAA figures come out in mid-April and we can have a global conversation. But America is the biggest recorded music market in the world. Also, it has, in recent years, we've been seeing the physical to digital and now the download to streaming shift, which is a global trend, but it does seem to be happening faster in the US than it is here in the UK, which is quite interesting.
Yes.
So it is. I think it's worth us not abandoning...
Look,
let's
just get it on the table now. It is worth us having this conversation now, so please don't write in and complain that we're having it.
Because we've spent so long now talking about this organisation's name, it would seem insane to not now talk about their figures. So tell us what was happening in the American record industry in terms of revenues in 2015.
Well, the big news and good news.
Good news.
I think we can all agree is good news.
Does this need a drum roll, this good news?
If you like.
I don't have a drum.
Well, let's pretend. Everyone imagine a drum roll.
People could imagine.
Yes.
Matt could put one in the edit.
Or jingle.
Or we could have
some sort of...
something to build up.
Drum roll-based jingle.
I mean, he might say that we arrived half an hour late to record this podcast and his Easter holiday starts this evening and anything else that we add will stop his holiday from starting. But I'm still looking forward to the drum roll in the edit.
Sometimes I doubt your commitment, Matthew.
Give us the big stat. It's an exciting stat.
Revenues in the US recorded music industry in 2015 were up.
They were up, ladies and gentlemen.
They were up 0.09%.
0.09%.
Hallelujah!
So that's everything's back. If those of you who are old enough to remember the record industry of the 90s, I'm just about old enough to remember
just
the record industry
76 now.
Of the 90s. The parties are coming back. The money flowing, the champagne and what else in the cupboards at the back of the meeting
room. The fruit and flowers.
It's all coming back, ladies and gentlemen. The record industry is back in growth. 0.09%.
Almost 0.1.
So the American record industry made more money in 2015 than it did in 2014. And I suppose to do a quick recap, the record industry saw its revenues worldwide decline from about 2000. I think 2000 was the peak. That was the end of the CD bubble. And then from 2001 all the way through to 2010, 2011, every year the record industry made less than the previous year. And then since about 2011, it's basically been flat, bumping
or
along
growing.
The bottom. Well, there was another year. I think it was 2012 where we saw a very slight spike. Not a spike, is it? It's a slight bump in the road.
Gotta take it where you can get it.
So the last 5 years has been flat. And so obviously, I think the global figures are going to show something a little bit similar, maybe even slightly better when the RFPI figures come out next month.
Depends on Japan, doesn't it? Always depends on Japan.
Bloody Japan screwing it all up. So everybody is hoping that this is the record industry turning the corner. And remember, these are revenue figures. And so the thing you have to remember is that digital is more profitable than physical. So although revenues are only ever so slightly turning the corner, the record industry is becoming more profitable. The profit margins are going up. So although revenues are only slightly up, you have to assume, it's harder to get your head around what's happening in terms of profitability, but we have to assume that profits are growing faster than revenues because digital has a higher profit margin. So that was the top line figure. A bit of good news just about. But I don't know what margins of error they have in these figures. That's the thing, isn't
there's
it?
No error.
They should be quite accurate, these figures, but you might find out there's a 2% margin of error, and then that's completely that's completely redundant. But let's assume that's not the case.
All right, we'll do that. Do you want positivity or gloom?
Let's get all the positivity out of the way first.
Okay.
Then we'll can focus on the gloom.
Streaming in the US is up 29%, or streaming revenues, rather, and now account for 34.4%. of all revenues, making it the biggest section of revenue in the industry.
Just. That's another just, because was downloads like 0.4?
Downloads are 34%, so it is a 0.4. And again, if there's a margin of error, it might be nothing.
But that's interesting, isn't it? So not only does the record industry in the US seem to be finally turning the corner, but crucially, if you take all the revenues across the board, then streaming is now the single biggest revenue stream. Only just, but nevertheless, it is the single biggest revenue stream. Downloads then come next, although they are in quite steep decline. And then CDs come next. Then I imagine it would be sync or vinyl. Maybe vinyl's ahead of sync now. I don't know. I mean, vinyl and sync. For all people talk about the vinyl revival, and whenever you meet music supervisors, they're always keen to tell you, it's all about sync now. We're here to save the music industry. It's about 2 or 3%.
2.9.
2.9% of the American record industry. But yeah, so streaming now is the single biggest revenue stream. And we have to assume, unless something mad happens, that that is now the trend. Because CDs continue to decline. Downloads continue to decline. Vinyl is still increasing, but it's still a really small part of the market overall. And streaming continues to boom. So every year that goes by, that streaming revenue stream is going to get bigger and the other two main revenue streams are going to go into decline. And I can foresee in the next few years that streaming will reach the 50% point, that 50% of the money that the recorded music industry makes. Now, obviously, globally, it will take longer because you've still got Japan and Germany, which are their physical markets, let alone streaming markets. So physical still dominates. But I think we are going to see the point that streaming starts to account for more than half of the money. When we talk about streaming, it's every possible incarnation of streaming.
Yes.
So it's Spotify Premium, Spotify Freemium, YouTube, Pandora-type services. I have a feeling in the US they bung Sirius in, which is actually satellite radio, so that's not really digital. I think for complicated reasons that also gets bunged in there.
So it's on the internet.
That possibly accounts for the 0.4%, which isn't really streaming. But that is interesting that streaming is now the dominant revenue stream if you take all of the different kinds of streaming and you lump them together.
Yes, and it's interesting because download is the gloom. Downloads down 9.6%, physical down 10.1%. So streaming has got to be the biggest thing because the other things are declining, other than sync that was up a little bit, but it still counts as almost nothing, no matter what anyone says.
And I suppose if you want more, well, not necessarily gloom, but if you want to worry, people like to worry, don't they?
Oh, yes.
If you want to worry about something, if you want to take that streaming figure and worry about it, well, there's two things you can worry about. And what the Recording Industry Association of America themselves were focusing on, and what quite a few of the people commenting and writing about this were focusing on, is the fact that, well, firstly, the per stream, if you take the number of streams and the amount of money and you do a sum, a simple division, then the value per stream is coming down. And across the board, but also if you predominantly focus on the paid for streams, also it's coming down. That's one thing that people have been talking about. The other thing is the value gap. The RIAA didn't call it the value gap.
They called it the value grab.
Which doesn't make sense.
No.
I don't know what that is. Anyway, the value gap, this is obviously something that the record industry and indeed the music publishers worldwide are talking about, which basically is, if you look at the consumption figures and at the revenue figures, most of the consumption comes from the free platforms. So Spotify free, Deezer free, but particularly YouTube and Vevo and services like that. And of course, in the US, you've also got Pandora and iHeart as free streaming services. So most of the consumption is on the free services, but most of the money comes from the paid for services. So you've got a small group of people who are bringing in most of the streaming revenue, and then you've got a lot of people accessing ad funded platforms, but there ain't much advertising. So there ain't much money. And that's often referred to as a value gap. And the record industry trade groups and the big labels and the publishers and the collecting societies feel that the free services are exploiting certain loopholes in the law. So in the US, actually, there's more of those because obviously a Pandora iHeartRadio service operates under a compulsory license. It's a statutory rate, it's the sound exchange rate, which the industry thinks is too low. AM/FM radio doesn't pay anything because of a whim of American copyright law. And YouTube exploits the good old safe harbors that we've talked about before on the podcast. And that's the global issue. And so that was the thing that they were waffling on about. But I would say for me, possibly the greatest concern of all is that now the single biggest revenue stream for the biggest recorded music market in the world and what could be the 50% revenue stream in the next few years is utterly reliant. We like some of the streaming services. We don't like some of the other streaming services. The one thing all the streaming services have in common is that they all lose money. You might question whether or not YouTube loses money. Google will tell you that it does. You might say, surely YouTube must make some money. But certainly Spotify, Pandora, iHeartRadio, Deezer, Apple Music, Tidal, they are all loss-making services. So we are now ever increasingly reliant as a record industry. I say we, I'm not. The record industry is ever increasingly reliant on services which are currently paying over big chunks of cash every month, but they're loss-making. And that's not sustainable.
Yeah, and Spotify obviously trying to raise another $500 million.
Something like that.
That is a concern because you don't want them to have to beg for money. You would quite like them to be making money so that, yeah, like you say, the record industry isn't almost entirely or a large chunk of it relying on something that has not been proven to work yet.
And I think it's true to say that we know ad-funded services aren't really bringing as much money. I mean, I think actually there's a lot more opportunities on the ad-funded side that have not yet been tapped, yeah, either because the music industry hasn't done it properly or the services haven't done it properly. But having said that, there is a finite sum of advertising money and there are lots of other people going after that advertising pound, so media and social media and so on. So really, it's all about premium. And it's about how many $10, 10 euro, 10 pound a month subscribers do Spotify and Apple Music, which are the big two, and then Deezer and Tidal and Rhapsody Napster, who I suppose are the next three of that model. How many subscribers do they need to be a viable business moving forward? Forget about the X billion they've already spent. Let's write that off. To become viable businesses month to month. Now, partly, some of their costs are that they all have insane growth strategies, which you might say, well, they have to get critical mass to work, so that makes sense. You might say, oh, well, that's all about building hype ahead of an IPO at some point in the future. So part of the reason they're losing money is just because they have incredibly ambitious growth strategies. But part of it is that they take all the risk. When they don't make money, they still have to pay the labels and the publishers and the collecting societies certain minimum rates. So a big chunk of their losses are coming from basically providing a buffer to the music industry. So how many subscribers do they need to be commercially viable month on month? And how can it, you know, whatever you think about streaming, well, either don't take part in streaming and withdraw your content, but if you're part of the streaming party, it's in everybody's interest. You just need more people to start paying. And it doesn't matter which service. It doesn't matter if it's Spotify or Apple Music. Well, if it's a service you think is probably not going to last the distance, then it's better for them to be with a service that probably is going to last the distance. But what can the music industry do to get more people signing up? And I think that's something beyond saying, well, YouTube's the problem, we'll change copyright law, and then we'll stop YouTube from being super-duper free, and then everyone will sign up to Spotify and Apple Music, etc. I think there's lots of other stuff that the industry at large could be doing to encourage more people to sign up. Even at the £10 a month bracket, I mean, I've said lots of times before, the majority of the market will never sign up at that price point. But I think there's still a lot of people who would sign up at that price point who are yet to sign up. What can the industry do to encourage more people to sign up? Because ultimately, if these businesses fail, well, everyone's screwed. And as the years go by, that becomes more and more true. So what is that? Well, that's not for us to solve on this edition of the CMU podcast.
No, we don't have time.
Perhaps we'll have another special edition. We'll get Brittany in.
Where we solve that.
We'll get Brittany in and she can solve it for us.
Okay.
Who knows?
Bit of legal news now. Songkick is still suing Live Nation, which I don't think we've discussed before.
It happened over Christmas.
Is that what happened?
Like 2 days before Christmas.
That's why we've not discussed it before.
Filed quite a big thing. It is quite a big thing.
So Songkick sued Live Nation just before Christmas, alleging that it was basically abusing its dominance in the live market, particularly the US live market, to lock smaller services out of working with artists who were aligned with Live Nation.
Which is a lot of artists.
Which is a lot of artists.
So Songkick obviously is a gig recommendation service. So they sort of started out as a data company and they gathered data about when artists were playing gigs, and then you would sign up to the service and it would start to learn about your music tastes. It would then marry the gig data over here with your music tastes over here, and it would recommend gigs to you. And then if you like the look of a gig that it recommends to you, you click a button, and then originally it would then take you to whichever website was selling tickets. So Ticketmaster, C-Tickets, or whoever. And then you go and buy the tickets. And then they get the affiliate, which isn't a lot of money, but critical mass. If you've got lots and lots and lots of people buying tickets via your introduction, then you can make some revenue out of that. And that was the original Songkick business model. But the business has been evolving in recent years. So first of all, they started selling tickets directly in the Songkick app. So obviously, they could only do that where they had an allocation. But there was the option as a promoter that rather than just having Songkick linking people off to Ticketmaster or C-Tickets or whoever, that the ticket could be sold there and then within the Songkick platform. And at the time, they said that that was a way of selling more tickets, because what their research suggested, and they're looking at the analytics, suggested is the more steps in the process between recommendation and ticket being bought, the less likely people were to buy tickets. They also said that a lot of the ticketing platforms, mobile apps or mobile web pages, were so awful that not only were there extra stages in the process, but you'd hit a point where you'd hit one of the big ticketing companies' mobile site and it'd be like, I have no idea what's going on here. And then you wouldn't sell tickets. So Songkick started selling tickets. Then they merged with CrowdSurge. That was last year, I think. Mm-hmm. CrowdSurge being a direct fan platform that did a lot of direct fan ticketing. So that pushed them even more into the ticketing space. And then behind the scenes, they've been working on some more interesting ticketing services, which sort of came to everybody's attention when it turned out that they were doing the pre-sales on the Adele tour.
Yes. So they did that. So it was the aim was to lock out touts, create a system that would stop tickets getting onto the secondary sites. And while they weren't 100% successful in that, it was pretty successful. But that was the pre-sale system. So when it went to general sale and you got into tickets being sold on Ticketmaster, which is owned by Live Nation, that was when tickets really started appearing on secondary sites and everyone was unhappy. And Ticketmaster kind of said, that's not our fault.
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
And I suppose what Songkick are clearly keen to do is they've got various bits to their business, but it seems that this idea of, okay, we're not going to compete head on with a Ticketmaster or C-Tickets when it comes to general release tickets, but perhaps we could become the experts on pre-sale.
Yeah.
So where you, so tickets go on sale normally on a Friday morning, don't they? But you go to your mailing list or your fan club and you say to your core fans, okay, you have 48-hour access. You do that through our system. We have an allocation to sell to sort of signed up fans. Maybe there's some benefit or you're guaranteed tickets. And then there was this idea of, at the very least, if we can give the signed up fans, the fan club, access to tickets, and for that 48-hour period, do everything we can to stop the touts. Okay, perhaps once they go on general release, there's nothing we can do to stop the touts. But we can ensure that signed up fans get access to the tickets before the touts come in and swoop up all the tickets that they swoop up using their clever technology and whatever. And it seems to me that Songkick are seeing that as this is a service that we can offer. They have good relationships with a bunch of artists. And so they're saying to artists, we're not going to take over from Ticketmaster or C-Tickets or whoever as your primary ticket seller, but work with us on pre-sale. Work with us on selling to the fans. We've got data, we've got a platform, we've got a brand, we've got this anti-touting service that we'll add on, and that could be good business for us. And so that is, seems to be where Songkick are evolving their business, pivoting. They're pivoting their business. And that's what Songkick are doing. And then the allegation in the lawsuit last December is we're hitting a wall because whenever Live Nation is involved, normally in this case, Live Nation would be the promoter of the tour, but they may also be the venue owner or the manager. Because Live Nation are big in management as well. That Live Nation are either telling artists who they're working with, don't work with Songkick. Ticketmaster, our ticketing company, has a pre-sale system. Work with us on it. Or they're adding fees. So if you want to sell through a third party, we add a bunch of fees, which ultimately make it uncommercially viable to use the Songkick system. So that was the allegation that was put in. It's an antitrust case in the US. It's a bold bit of litigation for a little startup. Yeah. I mean, they're a big startup in terms of users, but they're still a relatively small startup. They are now backed by Access Industries, the same company that owns Warner Music and is now the biggest backer in Deezer. So they have a wealthy backer. But even so, to take on Live Nation, the biggest live music company in the world, is quite an ambitious thing to do.
Yes, and just to help things along, they've now filed new legal papers this week. That's what's happened. Basically accusing Live Nation of getting worse on this matter. So they claim that Live Nation's retaliated to their original legal action by putting even more barriers in place for any Live Nation artists who wanted to work with Songkick. And according to the Wall Street Journal, this new filing says that Live Nation has been demanding that Songkick pay the company what it would have earned if Ticketmaster, rather than Songkick, had conducted the pre-sales for the artists using the system.
Basically giving Songkick, presumably, a zero profit.
Basically, yeah. So you're making it uncommercial for the artist and for Songkick, which ultimately, who's going to use the service if that's the case? I mean, you know, they're trying to make it so Songkick don't even want to use their own service.
And as you say, the allegation is that they're ramping up even further the barriers in Songkick's way in retaliation for the fact. You know, the reason it's getting worse isn't just because it was naturally getting more severe, but in retaliation. And if you think that's a paranoia, well, they were citing who knows who, but they were saying that they had actually been told by someone at Ticketmaster that that's exactly what is happening. So these are all the allegations that Songkick are making. Live Nation haven't really gone public on this, although they have submitted some legal papers since the initial litigation was filed last December. And basically what they were saying was, well, we're the promoter of the tour, and therefore we control the tickets. That's the deal that we do with artists when we put up the money and we invest and take all the risk in the tour. The deal is that we control the tickets. Yes, it's industry standard these days that you give the artist an allocation for them to sell to their mailing list before things go on general release. And quite what that allocation is varies from artist to artist and country to country. But ultimately, they are our tickets. And so we're allowed to ultimately, this is what the exact words they were using, I don't think, but basically saying we're ultimately allowed to do whatever we like with those tickets.
Yeah.
And we can have whatever terms we like with those tickets. And so they were sort of very much bouncing back and saying, this is just our agreement with our artists and trying to deny that there are any anti-competition or abuse of market dominance, which basically is what is at the heart of this case.
I mean, it is true that it's quite hard to be innovative in ticketing because there is this massive dominant player in the market. And so the strategy most startups in ticketing have is that they hope they'll build something good enough that it gets Live Nation's attention and then Live Nation will buy it. They don't normally go and sue Live Nation and accuse them of being anti-competitive, because that is surely suicide. Though, you know, Songkick clearly think that they have a case and they can get somewhere with it and come out of the other end of it in a better position.
You're right. I mean, as a ticketing company, it is hard to foresee a future where you will not have to work with Live Nation in some way, and whether that's that you aspire to be acquired or you form a partnership. One of Songkick's main competitors, which is an American service called Bands in Town, which does something very similar to Songkick, have just announced an alliance with Ticketmaster in that they are sort of integrating Ticketmaster's technology to make it a more seamless process when you buy tickets that have been recommended through the Bands in Town app. So rather than looking at Live Nation as a partner or possibly someone who might acquire the business down the line, it is quite confrontational to pursue litigation. I don't really know anything about American copyright law, so I'm not in any position to state whether or not there is a case and who seems to have the better legal arguments. We'll have to wait and see. I mean, I think there's going to be an initial hearing next month on this, although I imagine this is the sort of case that could rumble on in the courts for the foreseeable future. But you're right, whenever ticketing apps come to us, I mean, there have been lots of ticketing startups in recent years, and many of them are great, and they're a much more user-friendly experience than the legacy ticketing companies, and they'll have anti-tout measures or membership measures or whatever. But the thing you always say to any ticketing startup is, if you are looking for scale, if you're going to be a grassroots service, then great. But if you're looking for scale, Well, come back to me when you've got some Live Nation arena tours on your books. Live Nation owning the venues, they're being the promoter, they may well be the management, and they are Ticketmaster. So good luck with that.
Yes.
So it will be interesting to follow this bit of litigation as it goes through the motions. But certainly for the time being, Songkick are going full ahead with their legal battle.
Yes, I'm sure this is something we'll come back to in the coming months.
Yes. Let's just hope they don't do one of those horrible settlements. And they see this one through. We'll see. Time now for the CMU approved slot. This is what has been missing from the podcast for 2 whole weeks. Let's just pretend we approved nothing while you were away, because who can remember? And we'll just have a look at what you've approved this week. Okay. This is a short week, though.
Yes.
Because of that bloody Good Friday. And normally on Friday, obviously, we have Vigsy's Club Tips. But because there is no CMU Daily on Friday, we had Club Tips on Thursday, which meant no approved on Thursday. So we've just got 3 artists to approve this week. But have you made them extra special to compensate for the lack of the 4th approved?
They're always extra special.
But are these extra, extra special?
Yes.
Baby Metal, former CMU Artist of the Year, Battle Metal?
Yes, for Artist of the Year 2014.
Okay, so why are we bigging up Baby Metal again?
Because they're back and they're good.
And for anyone who has managed to miss the Baby Metal phenomenon, remind us what it is.
Baby Metal are a Japanese pop group whose unique selling point is that they mix metal and pop, which is not exactly a thing that they've invented, but it is. I mean, they're basically a girl group with a metal band playing behind them, and they manage to mix that sound in a way that isn't awful.
Because I think it's fair to say, on one level, it's a bit of a gimmick, but it's a gimmick that creatively works.
Well, I think the thing, as I noted in the approved write-up, it's sort of, because in 2014, Baby Metal were this massive global success that no one saw coming. I was in Japan that year, and like everyone in the Japanese music industry was like, why are you listening to this band? But since then, it's sort of become a bit of a thing, like mixing pop and metal. Most people do it quite badly. There are some bands who do it interestingly, and who do it like more with more less, like there's a black metal girl group and there's some hardcore girl group. Some of them take it darker. There's Lady Baby. Do you think Baby Metal's a gimmick? Lady Baby's gimmick is that there is a big Australian man with pigtails and a beard who dresses in like a pinafore, and there's 2 girls who do the kind of sweet singing bit, and then he roars a bit. It's very odd. So, I mean, in terms of gimmicks, Baby Metal seem quite normal after that. Anyway, they're back. They're coming back with their second album, and obviously a second album for a bit of a gimmicky band is quite a tough sell, but their first single, it's good stuff. I think it's going to work.
Called Karate.
Karate, the single. I've forgotten what the album's called, but it's out in April.
So check out that single and anticipate album number 2 from Baby Metal. Lavoie.
Lavoie, who is perhaps a more traditional artist. She's sort of a singer, songwriter, producer. Her new album is out this week, so out now, if you want to go and listen to it. She's pop, with quite a layered sound, a lot of kind of analog synth stuff going on. So it's got a sort of a classic pop sound, but kind of modern production. It sounds really good. It's got a big sound. She's sort of, I don't think she's very well known, but this thing popped up in my inbox. I listened to it and it was good, so I wrote about it. And the album's very much worth checking out.
And now our listeners do know about it.
Yes.
So that's a little service that we've done there. Eyewear Experiment.
Eyewear Experiment.
Not spelt like you might think it was spelt.
No.
It has nothing to do with glasses.
No. Eyewear as in eyewear.
Clothes.
Clothes. And Experiment. Yes. As in Experiment. So they wear Experiment. It's not a name that makes sense, but let's just let that go.
The song is called Patience.
Yes, it's from their new album, also called Patience, which is out at some point.
In the future.
But this track, so they talk about, in their biog, they talk up like, oh, they're a post-rock electronic band. They're a pop group, is what they are. They write very good pop songs, and they have, like, I guess, elements of what you might call post-rock, but not really. It's a really good pop song, this. It's got a very good video, which you can go and watch if you go to completemusicupdate.com/approve, where you'll find all of these and the things that approved last week, which who can remember what they were.
And if you're a Spotify user, you can now go and listen to the CMU approved Spotify playlist.
That's true.
Which has been going for a while, but we've never mentioned it on the podcast before. So if you're one of those people who says, I like the approved bit of the podcast, it's really annoying that they don't play any little snippets of the songs, and then we say, oh, that's PPLPRS, and they say, well, sort that out, and we haven't done yet. Well, this is a little middle solution to that. So once this podcast is over, go and check out the CMU-approved playlist on Spotify. If you go to any CMU-approved on the website, at the bottom there's a link through to it.
Yeah.
And you can stream away the tracks we've recommended this week and all the tracks we've ever approved this year.
Yes. Well, there are playlists for previous years too.
But this year's the one that matters.
That's the one that counts. Back onto Spotify again, the thing that we always talk about. It is quite a big thing in music at the moment, though,
isn't it? Is. And that's, especially now they've got that CMU-approved playlist.
Well, exactly. I mean,
that's what really made it for those guys.
It really is. It's what turned it all around.
And on the back of that,
they've now got 30 million paying subscribers.
Now, on the CMU podcast in the past, we have sometimes mocked or maybe critiqued Spotify for insisting on having ridiculous press conferences, usually in New York, where they get a load of journalists and industry people, and sometimes they stream them. They try and do the Apple thing, basically, which, I mean, doesn't even really work for Apple these days. It was sort of a Steve Jobs thing, wasn't it? And Tim Cook tries his best. But insisting on having big, glitzy press conferences to announce something which, frankly, they could just send us in a 6-bullet-point email. I sort of sense that Spotify boss Daniel Ek may have taken that to heart because he did the opposite of that to put out what is actually quite a significant milestone for the company.
Yeah, he retweeted something.
It wasn't even a tweet, it was a retweet.
He retweeted someone else tweeting about Obama visiting Cuba.
There was that photo, I think it was Reuters put out, yeah, which was President of America's plane flying over sort of quite rundown streets in Cuba. And so that was the photo. He retweeted it.
And then said, oh, we've got 30 million subscribers, but none of them are in Cuba. All right, Daniel.
And they're basically saying, hey, Cuba, now that you're dealing with the rest of the world again, coming soon, Spotify, and everything will be fine.
I'm sure it's what the people of Cuba need first.
But it was one of those things where the tweet came in and I saw it. You sort of tuned out from Twitter recently, haven't you?
I don't know what Twitter is.
But I saw it come in on the feed as it was tweeted. And it was one of those things, he was so nonchalant about it. Your immediate response to that is, oh, perhaps they announced that. Did they announce that? I'm pretty sure it was 20 million was the last official, but perhaps they announced it last week and I missed it. And it's like, do I tweet about that and say, oh, look, he's just revealed something? Or does that make me look really stupid? It was some big announcement that I've completely forgotten about. But no, lo and behold, it was the official announcement that Spotify had now passed. So they had 20 million just before Apple Music launched. And now they've got 10 million. Apple Music, we think, has now got up to about 12 million. So Apple Music has grown slightly faster. But I think what Spotify want people to recognise is that the fact that that big new competitor entered the market last summer ain't stopping the growth of their paid-for subscribers.
Yes, because they're increasing the rate they're signing people up, because it was 15 million in January 2015 and then 20 million in June last year and now 30 million in March. And who knows where in 9 months' time?
41, I would imagine.
41.
Maybe 42. Obviously, these are the paid-for users. Spotify also have their freemium users. So the last official figure on that was 75 million.
Which is a figure they're still sticking to.
Officially, when they say how many users they've got in total, they're still saying 75 million. But they have to be pretty close to 100 million now overall. So we assume we're pretty close to 100 million users in total, of which 30 million are paying. But given that we're sometimes accused of being too upbeat about Spotify, let's just put that little footnote that we sometimes apply at this moment, that 100 million users, 30 million paying is a really impressive figure until you add up the population of all the countries that come, because they're in, 60 plus countries. So their potential reach is over a billion. So then that sort of puts the 100 million into context.
Yes, it's a very small percentage of the people they could be reaching.
But still, let's not knock their achievements there. The other Spotify news that has occurred since the last podcast when you weren't here, so not the Convergence special, the one
the
with Brittany 2 weeks ago, talking about the ongoing squabble and dispute in the US between songwriters and publishers and Spotify over unpaid mechanical royalties. Actually, as we know, there are disputes between all of the streaming services that are operational in the US. We won't go into that in any great detail because I think we went into it in quite a lot of detail 2 weeks ago. But the point is that 2 weeks ago, we were under the impression that some sort of settlement was going to be made with Spotify. That was then revealed in the last 2 weeks. So the National Music Publishers Association, which is the US trade body for the music publishers, has agreed a deal with Spotify over the unpaved mechanicals that has a number of elements to it. First of all, that all of the unpaved mechanicals are going to be paid, which, depending on who you talk to, is anywhere between about 15 and 25 million. So a sizable chunk of that half billion that they're currently raising. They are also going to set aside 5 million to compensate people for the fact that they should have got these payments in the past and they're getting them late. So a sort of a sorry we got it wrong fund. And then some formal commitments. They've made informal commitments already. Some formal commitments about sorting out the issues with paying mechanicals, which of course all stem from the fact that the record companies don't tell Spotify what songs are contained in which recordings. So therefore, they don't know which songs they're streaming and therefore they don't know which publishers and songwriters to give the money to. Database could fix that problem. Spotify have now formally pledged to build that database, although everyone's still a little bit vague about this thing that's going to happen in September that's suddenly going to make all this money flow out there.
It's not like no one's tried before. So, yeah, we'll see how that works out.
Well, I mean, what they need is what every other country has, which is a collecting society to take responsibility for it. So there is one organisation, an MCPS-type organisation. And, I mean, BMI and ASCAP sort of could do this. The consent decrees don't let them, so it would need a change in the copyright law. But in every other country, you make it a collecting society's problem. So Spotify just gives all the money to a collecting society and then they work out who is paid the money and they can do the work and they often already have the database pretty much there. So that is what the US is lacking, but that's not what is going to be built. So who knows what's going to happen? We'll see down the line. But Spotify have now done this deal. Two things to add to that, which firstly is just because the NMPA have negotiated this settlement doesn't mean that publishers or self-published songwriters need to sign up. So what that now means, if you are a songwriter who self-publishes or you're a publisher in the US, you now have a decision to make, assuming that there are unpaid mechanicals due to you from Spotify. You either sign up to the settlement and you get your money in theory within the next 6 months, you'll get a cut of that 5 million, although I imagine that will get sliced and diced quite a bit. So I don't think it's going to be a massive payday. And hopefully your mechanicals will start coming through on a timely basis. Or you don't do that and you join one of the class action lawsuits who are pursuing this under copyright law, copyright infringement, and you go for your damages. Although you might earn more in damages by going that route rather than your cut of the 5 million, which probably won't be very much by the time it's been sliced between everybody. Although if you do go the class action route, that still doesn't fix the problem moving forward. But it is either or. A condition of signing up to the settlement is that you can't do the lawsuit route. So it'll be interesting to see. I think most of the publishers, we're under the impression certainly the majors and the big independents will go with the NMPA because they've been involved in that settlement. It remains to be seen what the little indies do and also what the self-publishing songwriters choose to do. The second thing to note is this is only a deal with Spotify. All the digital services are basically in the same boat. We assume now that the other services will probably seek to do pretty much the same deal that Spotify has done, although they don't all necessarily have access to as much cash as Spotify to do the 5 million settlement. But we expect a series of other template settlements to be announced from the other services in the coming months. Who knows? Perhaps the US record industry, after 60 years, will finally sort out its utterly inept system for paying mechanical royalties.
Yeah, well, we'll see. Got time to very quickly run through a few of the stories that we're not discussing in detail this week, but have happened, so are worth mentioning. Like Paul McCartney trying to get his publishing for Beatles songs back off Sony ATV.
So there are two bits to this. First of all, since our last podcast, Sony has announced it is buying the Michael Jackson estate out of Sony ATV.
So $750 million.
So Sony has a record company over here and a music publishing company over here, like everyone else. But until now, the publishing company was actually a JV with the Michael Jackson estate. And prior to that, Michael Jackson. But they are buying the estate out, so it will become a wholly owned subsidiary of the Sony Corp moving forward. And that news story breaking then got lots of people reinterested in what was going on with the Lennon-McCartney repertoire, which is arguably the most famous of the songs that are controlled and owned by Sony ATV. In the US, there's a system that says after a certain number of years, after a publishing contract has been signed, the songwriter has the right to take their copyrights back. The word is that Yoko Ono, as the John Lennon estate, has already done a deal with Sony ATV, so she can't now exercise her reversion right. But McCartney hasn't, so he can exercise his reversion rights. And Billboard went digging because McCartney's catalogue was back in the news and discovered that papers had actually been filed back in December with the US Copyright Office, basically McCartney putting Sony ATV on notice to say, when my reversion right kicks in, which is in the next few years on my catalogue, I want my bit of the songs back, although this does only apply to the US. Yes. So Sony ATV control Lennon McCartney catalogue in territories all over the world, and it will only apply to the US. But it will be more fragmentation of rights, because it will, unless McCartney does a new deal with Sony ATV and gets a load more money off them, then it will mean that one company will represent the McCartney bit. So Sony ATV will still represent the Lennon bit. Someone else will represent the McCartney bit in America, but then outside of America. So this is how the stupid mechanical royalty disputes happen, because copyrights keep getting sliced and diced. Anyway, that was the Sony ATV / McCartney development.
Sticking with Sony, Sony Music has done a licensing deal with SoundCloud at bloody last.
Last of the majors on board. So they're now pretty much sorted on the recording side.
Yeah, and we've discussed all that at length before, so let's not get into it now.
SoundCloud can launch their bloody subscription service that they've been talking about since the early 1920s. And we'll see what that looks like.
Sticking with Sony, Kesha has now filed an appeal against the ruling that she couldn't get an injunction against Sony and Dr. Luke, her producer, to record with a different company while her legal action against Dr. Luke is going through the motions.
Yep, so we talked about that the other week.
At this stage, we don't know whether that appeal will be successful or not.
But
we'll find out.
The paperwork has been filed.
In listings news, building and stuff listing...
When buildings have a listing that means that they can't be knocked down.
Yeah.
That's what we're talking about. We just can't find a good way of introing it.
Yeah, so that David Bowie mural in Lambeth is going to be listed by Lambeth Council.
So that was the mural that just sort of appeared.
Well, it had been there since 2013.
That's
but
right.
When he
became
died,
a bit of a hub.
Loads of people went to it and put flowers there.
That's right.
And now...
So it started off as a tribute, but then became a memorial.
Yes, and it's on the wall of a department store, and the council's going to list it. They're considering changing the name of the street that it's on, although they're in discussions with the Bowie family to work out if they want to actually do that.
But the department store had already said that it was going to make sure that it was...
And people have written messages on the wall. The department store said that they're going to preserve those.
It being his home borough.
Yes.
More or less.
Or one of the ones that claim to be his home borough. And then a house where the Sex Pistols recorded, or they actually recorded an outhouse out the back of it, but that has been upgraded in its listing status to the highest, so that it's very much protected. That's on Denmark Street in Soho. Obviously, a very famous music street for many reasons, but the Sex Pistols recorded there. Glenn Matlock and Steve Jones lived above this outhouse, and it's got graffiti by John Lydon still in this building. That's being protected under the listing status in this 40th anniversary year of punk, another way the establishment has grabbed hold of that anti-establishment movement.
But it means that top listed status for that building, which means that unlike the rest of Denmark Street, it won't be knocked down, whereas it seems that most of that part of London is being utterly redeveloped at the moment.
Yeah, and finally, talking about anti-establishment, Dave Grohl has taken on Cornwall Council.
And why not?
Why not, indeed. A little teenage band who were practising in one of their parents' garages got told they had to play very quietly or not at all.
Yeah, so weirdly, the council out of the blue said, you're playing your music too loud, you can only play it at this volume, which basically made it unworkable.
Yeah.
And the family of the band were basically saying... Well, that can't be right. We've got one neighbour who we know has no problem with it. Our other neighbours are quite a way away. What's this about? And then they were trying to find an alternative rehearsal space for them. And in amongst all of that, they asked Dave Grohl, because he'd said something about how every teenager should go in the garage and learn to play music.
Yeah. And so they appealed to him
to intervene.
To intervene, which obviously you would think, that's not going to happen. But it has happened. He's written a letter to the council saying, come on now, let these guys play in their garage.
So it remains to be seen how the councillors of Cornwall respond to Dave Grohl intervening on a little noise issue there.
Yeah, and you can read all of those stories in full on our website. If you go to completemusicupdate.com/podcast, you'll find the show notes for the show where you'll find the links for those stories.
So you said and finally, but that was and finally from a one-liner perspective.
Yeah.
And now it's and finally from an and finally perspective.
Yeah, and Bieber's back.
Justin Bieber wrapping up. Well, it is Easter, so it seems just right that we have...
It may not have been appropriate to talk about me as the Messiah in the intro, but right here...
The Messiah of pop.
Yeah. Justin Bieber is in. He's not doing meet and greets anymore.
So that's the Bieber news this week. He put out a Instagram post saying... It made me think of Ringo Starr. Because it was a real... I love you guys. I love my fans. But I love you all.
Don't come near me.
I don't want to be in the same room as you. So this is the thing, isn't it, in pop music? Meet and greets. And I think it started, originally meet and greets were one of two things. And a meet and greet, so fans get to meet the band backstage before the show or after the show. And I think originally they were a competition prize thing. You should give them away.
Or it was a thing to promote a new single or album.
Yeah, and then it became a bit of a fundraising thing that charities start to say, oh, we could get that and we'll raffle it off or we'll auction it off or whatever. But it seems to have become a real revenue generator in the pop industry that pop stars now for... And I mean, it's a real segmentation of the population because often it's hundreds, if not thousands.
The top level Bieber meet and greet was $2,000. And I think the cheapest one was like $900.
So you've got to have some pretty wealthy slash insane parents to be spending that
sort
of money.
Justin Bieber is cutting off a pretty hefty revenue source, and he's got to have a good reason for that.
Have you ever been to one of these meet and greets?
Of course I haven't been to one of these meet and greets. I try to avoid meeting people as much as possible.
I just can't help thinking, what happens? I just can't help thinking...
Well, you go and have a picture taken and then you leave.
And have a really awkward conversation, I assume.
I think it depends what the terms and conditions stipulate. I think sometimes possibly no conversation.
Just there was a selfie.
I think BuzzFeed collected together a load of pictures of Avril Lavigne meet and greets. And it was stipulated that you couldn't touch her. You had to stand a certain distance away from her. And there's just all these pictures where she and the people she's having a photo with look really, really awkward. And they've paid like hundreds of dollars to have this picture. And it's just this awful picture. But I don't understand, like, why would you do this? Like, surely, like...
As an artist or as a fan?
Well, either. But I think as a fan, like, your fantasy as a fan would be that one day, like, you'd bump into, like, your favourite pop star in a bar or a party. And then you'd kind of strike up a conversation and they'd be like, hey, you're really cool, why don't we be friends? Like, what benefit do you get from going, like, you know, can you say to your friends, like, oh, yeah, I met Justin Bieber once. Like, oh, really? How did that happen? It's like, well, I gave him $2,000 and we had a photo taken and I went home. Like, well, oh, how's that good? That's just rubbish.
I suppose it's the modern version of standing at the stage door to get an autograph, which I must admit, as a teenager, I did that. But with hindsight, it's like, I know these days you get a photo, but an autograph is even more insane. It's just a scrawl on a piece of paper. What does that even prove? There was a documentary about the people who used to follow Michael Jackson around the world. Did you ever see that?
I did see that.
And it was one of those where...
They didn't even meet him.
Well, exactly. They just used to shout at him at the hotel. Occasionally he would wave at them and they would stand outside the venue. But halfway through the documentary, it was like, hang on a second. These fans have now... been 6 months on the road. Do these people not have jobs? How do these people pay to eat, let alone fly around the world? So the whole thing strikes me as being decidedly odd. I just can't help thinking that what has a 22-year-old guy got to say to a 12-year-old girl?
Nothing, because he has cancelled it. Would you like to know what we said? What benefit is there for the fan? What benefit is there for the artist? Justin Bieber has told us what benefit there is for the artist. None.
Yes,
other
he has
than
indeed
financial.
Said that.
However, the financial benefit does not outweigh the problems.
So the story is there's an official reason, which is what he posted on Instagram, and then there's a rumour that it was actually there were some security issues.
I think Justin Bieber's reason is more likely.
Okay, so let's ignore the fact that there was a rumour that some security incident had happened and that had caused the meeting. He even had an agency to... There's a whole company who organises Justin Bieber meet and greets. But let's just forget about any of that gossip. Let's just go for what the Messiah of Pop spoke.
He said, well, I'll quote him exactly. He said, love you guys. Which is how Justin Bieber speaks. I'm going to be cancelling my meet and greets. I enjoy meeting such incredible people, but... I end up feeling so drained and filled with so much of other people's spiritual energy that I end up so drained and unhappy. So that's why he is cancelling them. And that's, I mean, as I said in my write-up, I can understand that someone who is on such a higher plane to the rest of us, it must be quite difficult to then meet just normal people and kind of suck in their normal person energy.
Yeah, if there was a second coming this Easter weekend, if Jesus genuinely rose again,
He's already here. Justin is already here.
You have to think, what would he have to say to the average worshipper?
You'd have to pay $2,000 for a meet and greet and get a photo with him.
You would. And then he'd probably meet a few people. His spirituality would be zapped and they would all be cancelled. So no more Bieber meets and greets. He really should have added a peace and love at the end of that Instagram. That would have made that message the perfect bit of pop moment. That doesn't even make sense, does it?
No.
Anyway.
But neither do meet and greets.
And neither,
doesn't matter.
And neither the Bieber Instagram posts. So that wraps all that up. No more meets and greets. If you'd like to meet and greet hosts of the CMU podcast, Chris Cook and Andy Malt.
Yeah, I mean, send in. I mean, well, just let us know. Let us know how much you would like to pay to stand near us. Bear in mind there are two of us, so it's going to cost more.
Yes.
But we're open to offers.
We are.
So let us know.
We will risk the unhappiness your spirit. What was the word he used?
Spiritual energy.
That your spiritual energy may cause us. We're willing to take that risk, people.
We'll take that risk for money. Yeah.
Or food. A steak dinner. I'd do it for a steak dinner. So I look forward to see what offers we get.
I would like cash.
Would you?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So there's that. So yeah, do let us know at CMU on Twitter, or I don't know, email us or nail it to a tree or something, how much money you want to give us. And while you're waiting for us to get back to you with an acceptance or refusal, why don't you tell two friends how much you've enjoyed this show and make them listen to it? In fact, you could take their phones off them and just download it to their phone and make them listen to it. I think that is a good way of getting more listeners.
But it's the Easter weekend. People will be hanging out with friends and family.
Yeah.
And
download it to all of your family's phones.
They don't have to work in the music industry.
In fact, it doesn't matter if you listen to it. We just want the stats. That's all I care about.
I would rather people listen myself. Yeah. But that's because I don't look at the stats. So that means nothing to me. But yeah, that's a little project for you all on this Easter weekend. Or if you're listening to this after the Easter weekend, on this post-Easter weekend week.
Yes, but do tell at least two friends all of your family.
Yeah, maybe five.
Maybe five.
If you have five friends. Maybe five friends.
Imagine having five friends.
Yeah. Imagine it.
These kids. This podcast was presented by me, Andy Malt, and him, Chris Cook. It was produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an Unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
I feel like I should have said something else there. That ended quite abruptly.
Yeah, that's fine.
Oh, yeah.